So, the subject that we're really talking about tonight, and tomorrow morning we're sort of going to extend it a little bit. Tonight we're talking about how to know and trust your inner guidance. This, for me, is a very popular topic to talk about, but is also, I always find this topic a little dicey to talk about, and I actually refused to teach it for many years. And at one point I said to Swami Kriyananda, I don't think we should really teach people about guidance anymore or talk to them about intuition because I see people so often misguided. And in the name of intuition, I see sometimes people do things that aren't really very wholesome for them, and I don't want to be part of making that worse. His response to me, and he's, you know, he's very direct, I don't think that's a good idea, he said. He said, intuition is fundamental on the spiritual path. It's one of the most central aspects of life, which is to learn to be guided in our lives by that which is really in our own best interests. And I was saying earlier that even though I had become dedicated to the idea of self-realization and the idea of shifting my consciousness, I did not have the willpower to extricate myself from all the forces around me. Even though I was in a group of people, they were the group of people were the very ones who had introduced me to these teachings. Later, I heard Yogananda had a phrase that I rebelled against when I first heard it, but I now respect. Environment is stronger than willpower, he said. My first response was not stronger than my willpower. No, I just didn't want to accept that. But I was unconscious at that time of the extent to which, without even realizing it, we simply take in the vibrations around us, and because they're so familiar to us, we don't realize that we're absorbing them. We walk around and we think we're being ourselves, when in fact we're just being a reflection of what our parents told us, what our best friends told us, of prejudices we developed at a certain point. I watched this little child once when I was at a health spa, at a club somewhere, and we were sitting in the sauna, and we were in a hot tub, and the child and the mother were there. The child was about 10 or 12. And the mother, who seemed to be a little bit of a petulant type, I don't even know who she was, she sat there, and they were talking about you're in the hot tub with total strangers, so you talk about the hot tub, because that's what you have in common. So we're discussing the hot tub. And the mother says, I prefer the dry heat of a sauna, she says like that. And her daughter looks at her mother and then says, I prefer the dry heat of a sauna too, just like that. And I just sort of watch this whole thing go forward. You know, she's a teenage girl, and they say, oh, let's go sit in the hot tub. No, I prefer the dry heat of a sauna. You know, her husband says, let's put a hot tub in the backyard. No, I prefer the dry heat of a sauna. You know, it's just like you could just see her absorbing this reality, making it her own reality, completely unexamined. I mean, it was the consciousness of the mother, and you could see it reflected in the child. You know, so often you see mother and child, and you just see this is a young version of that. Even though this one, the young one, doesn't want to be that, though in the eyes it's the same look. That's what I was looking at. I was looking at twins in different age bodies. Okay. Now, that's a very minor thing, because we're brought up from the start by the way God's terrible trick is that all of our senses are outward looking. You know, just from the very start, we're looking outward. I was present, I have no children of my own, but I was present at the birth of one of my friend's little baby girl. And the girl was born in the hospital, and she had just a little bit of distress, not a lot, but a little bit. And so the nurse took the baby back into the ICU place, and I don't know, I just followed. I don't think I was supposed to be there. The father went along, and we left the mother, and we went back there. And little girl, she's minutes old, literally. She looks up into her father's eyes. She reaches out her hand. She takes his finger. I mean, so touching. But then, in addition to that, there she is, just reaching out from herself to hold on to something. And that's what children do. You watch children all the time. That's what their lives are about. Their lives are about looking outside and reaching and trying to understand what it is that's going on in this world and to try to make some sense out of what is really totally chaotic. In Autobiography of a Yogi, Yogananda has just a few sentences. He talks about being born into this Bengali family. He talks about lying there as an infant, and out of the multitude of different languages going around in his mind, okay, based on the idea of past incarnations in which he spoke in many different languages, he gradually sorted out that these people were speaking Bengali, and he began to speak Bengali with them. You know, I mean, it's just like, okay, where am I and what are they doing? And so they start speaking to him in a certain way, and he starts speaking back to them. That's why little children can learn languages so fast, because they're in a total mode of imitative. And we have to learn everything. You know, when a child, it's a developmental stage when a child discovers his own feet. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're frightened by their own feet because they have no idea where they've come from. Or they're frightened by their own hands because suddenly this moving object is right in front of them and they don't have any idea. And then you gradually learn, oh, this is my body and this is how I move it. And I put the food in the spoon and I put the spoon in my mouth. And all of that has to be acquired. In India, you pick it up with your fingers like this. In China, you pick it up with chopsticks. In America, you use a spoon. And why do we each learn these things? Because we're imitating what's going on around us. Isn't that so? This little boy, a friend of mine, child, who is about 2, and he was just beginning to make sense out of the chaos of his world. And I came over to visit his family, and he'd made a huge discovery, which he thought was so important. He had to share it with me before anything else happened. So he took me by the hand, and he dragged me upstairs, and he took me to his bedroom. His mother kept a very orderly house, and he put his hands on this bottom drawer of the bureau, and he just looks up at me like, you are not going to believe this. He opens the drawer, and it's filled with socks. And he screams pretty much as loud as he can scream, socks, like that. Okay, that's just fabulous. He's not done. He pushes it closed again. And then he looks at me with just this look of, this is, you know, like you thought that was good. And then he opens it again, and by Jove, socks, they're still in there. You know, and he just keeps opening and closing the drawer. And every single time he does, it's this incredible, like, consistent clue to what's going on this planet. Behind this wall, there are socks. Every time I open the drawer, there are socks. You know, we just take that for granted, but, like, how would he know? But everything we do, the language we speak, the food that we like, the preferences that we have, our concept of what this world is like. When my husband had a horoscope done by an Indian astrologer a number of years ago, the astrologer used this exact phrase, from birth to 18 years was one of the most fortunate, auspicious periods. Unfortunately, was the most auspicious period of your life was from birth to 18 years, like that, or one of the most. And when Swami Kriyananda heard that, he said, no. He said, that's not unfortunate. He said, that's very, very good karma. Because if you're born into a very auspicious astrological period, your entire orientation toward life, and my husband has that attitude, you just have this attitude that everything works. And even when things don't work, you still have the attitude that everything works. And it gives you this kind of jump start in positive energy. You don't have to work so hard to get it. He said it was very good karma to be born right into that really ascending arc. And he did. He had this perfectly charmed childhood. You know, he met all his friends when they were all in diapers together, and they lived together all the way until they went to college, and they all went off to college together even. But, you know, just that kind of very stable, very supportive, very positive energy. But we all start making decisions about what life is like from the womb, from before the womb, but let's just deal with here. But even what it means to be a human being, what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a man. I never was much of a girl. I found a fashion consultant when I was about 30 who trained me to be a girl. She was a very girl. And then I brought all my other non-girl girlfriends, and she taught us all how to be girls. She taught us what to do with our hair, how to put on makeup, what to do with earrings. It was just a complete and total mystery to me. I had no idea how to do it. It just wasn't in me. And because then I became a public person and I had to look like a girl. So I learned how to do it. And now I got to just throw it all away again. I was so happy. Yippee! Gone! But all of that, you see, is just what we decide. And what we think is girls, you know, what we think a woman should look like is based on where we live and what we're like, what race, body, culture we're in, and what fashion zone we're in. Just 1,000 different things, the same thing, what it is to be a man, What constitutes real masculinity? What constitutes success? All of those things, they're all imitative. That's what they all have in common, you know? And you travel around the world, and, you know, many cultures have external characteristics that you can see, the shape of the eyes, the color of the skin, or things like that, but many cultures do not. And especially in America, where we are such a melting pot that every country in the world lives here, so we don't have a distinct idea that this is what Irish looks like, or English, or Swedish. They all look like Americans to us. So when you go around the world, they all look normal to you. But it's very interesting, after a while, before people speak, you can often tell what country they're from. Because they'll just have an aura about them. Those people could only be French. Those must be Italians. And I'm not as good at it as Swami Kriyananda is, who can just pretty much hit it 100%. But I was surprised by how obvious it is. And then you find people who don't belong to any country at all. You haven't the foggiest idea where they're from. And even when they speak, you don't know. Increasingly, in our times, we meet those people because of the globalization of the whole world. But there's another reason why people are like that, is because even though they were born and raised in one particular culture and have a gender and have an ethnicity, they have remained always themselves. And they have not allowed who they are to be co-opted by their environment. Okay? Now, all of that is why just starting to say, oh, I think I'll be guided by intuition, oh, I think I'll start living my life by intuitive guidance, it's not so simple. Even though the potential, we all have the same basic equipment. It's not like some people are born with extra genetic material, you know, or something that makes it easier for them. We all have exactly the same potential. We all have the same inner consciousness, but we don't all have the same access to it. Because access is what is evolutionary individually. We develop it over time. So in a very simple sense, let me just start now with a few points. What blinds us to true intuition is a very simple reason. We are pre-prejudiced in one way or another. We have, in other words, likes and dislikes. You know, and even if we're relatively even-minded, we are biased in one way or another. And so we can only, the limit of our ability to hear is limited by our willingness to hear. I had a very interesting experience with Swami Kriyananda, which I included in the book. I point over there because the books are over there, which I included in among the stories I wrote about experiences with Swami Kriyananda. I was faced with an extremely difficult personal situation. I had to make some decisions. The decisions were not, I was distressed to have to make decisions at all, and none of the choices that were in front of me looked very good to me. But I was devoted to doing the will of God, so I exercised my good intentions by sort of, I wept and I wailed and I cried out and I prayed. I was very dramatic. I've calmed down a lot, but I was very dramatic. But I was just in this state of tremendous turmoil. What does God want me to do? What does God want me to do? And finally, I managed to get an opportunity to speak to Swami Kriyananda about this personal dilemma that I had, which in those days was not so difficult because everything, he was more accessible. And I came into his house where he was living, and he was sitting in a big armchair, and there was an ottoman, a matching ottoman in front of it. And he was sitting in the armchair, and I sat, as it happened, I sat on the floor on the other side of the ottoman. And I'm talking to him, and I'm describing to him, you know, this situation, and I don't know what to do. And, you know, and finally it was just all too much for me, and I began to weep, and I said, it's so hard to know what God wants, I said like that. And then I dramatically threw my head down on the ottoman, you know, and just started weeping like this. And Swami he wasn't unkind, but he was extremely impersonal. You know, he just looked at me, and I had just declared, it's so hard to know what God wants. And he said, no, it's not. That's it. Mm-hmm. And I kind of waited for a little more, you know, like something, you poor dear, you're trying so hard, you know, this is really difficult. Nothing. He was sweet, but he was just silent. I just sort of realized that, well, I guess this conversation is over, and we chit-chatted a little about very inconsequential things, and I just got up and went home. And I was bewildered. He doesn't speak in koans as a rule. And so I went back. I was living in this little trailer. I wasn't married at the time, and I was living in this little trailer, and I sat down in my meditation spot, and I thought, well, it's really hard for me to know. It may be easy for him, but it's hard for me. But then I heard his words, and he's a wordsmith. He's a writer and a speaker. He says exactly what he means. He did not say, it's not hard for me to know. He wasn't speaking of himself. He just said, no, it's not hard to know. And I thought, well, it's really hard for me to know. I could certainly say that. But if it isn't difficult, why is it difficult for me? So whereas prior to that, I'd been beseeching, I thought, you know, God to reveal himself and tell me what I should do. Instead, I said, I changed my prayer. And my prayer was, why am I having such a hard time understanding? And then I had this inner conversation, and I think Swamiji was projecting the thoughts to me, which is what happens when you have a relationship with a soul of expanded consciousness, Yogananda included. That's how they talk to you. They talk to you, they project thoughts into the ether, and when you try to match your vibration, then suddenly those thoughts will come in. They will not break through your resistance. But they will, if you match their vibration, you will find them. That's the way I would put it. So I asked the right question, not what should I do, what should I do, but why am I having such a hard time? Immediately the answer came, because you don't really want to know. And just the simple truth of that was so irrefutable, there was nothing I could say. And I said, why don't I want to know? The next answer was, because you're afraid. So, okay, now we're getting somewhere. Then the next question is, what am I afraid of? And the answer was, of what you know you have to do, which is you are not confused, you're just unwilling. It's a huge difference. And then I went back to Swamiji a day or two later and I sort of replayed it for him. I said, okay, this is what I'm getting from this. And I just repeated those things. If I really wanted to know, it'd be easy to know, wouldn't it? He said, oh, yes. Just like that. He said, but everybody is just bound up with all these inner fears and inner limitations. That's not a criticism. That's just a fact. And if we're going to be successful at what we're doing, we have to start with facts. It doesn't serve us to just try to affirm things out of existence. There's a great deal of teaching these days, with all due respect, which is true enough to sound good and false enough to be almost dangerous. Because it leads us down tracks where we cannot succeed. I used to get a lot more of this in earlier decades, what I would call refugees from the New Age. Because they were people who'd been told that they could affirm their way to anything, wealth, health, relationships, success, and they would just try to affirm their way to it. They would fail. And then they would come to me as failures, you know, weeping and unhappy about their inability to manifest. But the method they were using would never work. Because the method they were using was just trying to paste onto the top, you know, something that the ego desired. And imagine that you could paste an ego desire and have soul power behind it. You see, what the ego wants and what the soul wants, unfortunately, do not always match. And what the soul wants, what God wants, there's many different ways you can say it. So there I was. And all of a sudden, I knew exactly what I had to do, and I really didn't like it. I really did not like it. It was not my story. It was not the story that I had written and that I had wanted. Things were not going to turn out the way I was determined they were going to turn out. There was no chance. And I really didn't want that. But once I just said, okay, Lord, then I've never been good at, even God knows where I stand. Everyone always knows where I stand. I don't hide what I feel. But Jesus set us the example in the Garden of Gethsemane. He said, Lord, let this cup pass from me. And he wasn't afraid of crucifixion. What he wanted was for his own people not to turn against him for their sakes, not his. You know, this bitter cup of, I come to bring the message of salvation and they're going to crucify me. This is really not the best ending. As he stood, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, I would have taken you under my wings like a mother mother hen guards her chicks, but you would not have it. So that was his, Lord, let this cup pass from me. But then he said, but thy will, not mine, be done. So I always take that as my model prayer. First, you express your opinion. You know, even when you know what's going to happen, you can express your opinion. And then after you've said your piece, then you say, but whatever you want, that's what I'm really going to do. So I went through that, and then, of course, I had to face into it, and, it, you know, everything happens for the best. No matter how unpleasant it is at the time, it turns out to be exactly what has to happen. But from that, I learned an absolutely invaluable lesson I've never forgotten. Whenever I am confused about what I think God wants me to do, instead of repeatedly asking what God wants, I say, what am I afraid of? I mean, it might be, what do I not like? But fear is the one that usually, speaking for myself, that's the one that usually gets me. What am I afraid of? And, you know, you have to wait a little while. You can't just answer that with a glib intellectual answer. You have to get deeper into yourself. Then you have to ask, why does that frighten me? You know, what is it? What's the fear behind the fear behind the fear behind the fear? And whenever you find that, and here's another aspect of it, and I'm just, you know, giving you some guidelines about this, which is very often we imagine that God has an opinion about things that he really doesn't care about. There are things that we care a great deal about because our idea of what the purpose of life is very, very different than what the divine purpose of life actually is. And tomorrow when we talk about dharma and karma and, you know, I guess this topic is learning to like what you have to do anyway, we'll talk a lot more in detail about, you know, what we're here for and how we can measure it. But we're born into a human body for one reason, which is we're here to expand our awareness. And it's that's a very useful way to put it. It's very non-sectarian. It encompasses all spiritual paths or no explicit spiritual path. But when you think about it, even from childhood, my little friend was expanding his awareness of where the socks are stored, right? A baby expands its awareness of what it can do with its body. We go to school and we expand our awareness from just symbols into words. And we travel and we expand into other cultures. Everything that is progress in your life, if you think about it, is because you become more and more aware of something that you weren't aware of before. Maybe you married an alcoholic because you were in denial and didn't know he was an alcoholic, or she, and you find out, you become aware of a reality here, or you become involved with someone because of some inner compulsions that you didn't know about, but you have repeating life patterns, and then gradually, suddenly, the spotlight gets turned back on you, and you become aware of something you weren't aware of. Maybe it was traumas from childhood. Maybe it's past life traumas that you can't specify, but nonetheless mold the way you think. You know, and as we gradually become aware, then awareness begins to give us more freedom, more mastery, more ability to choose. When we're unaware, we're compelled. And the goal of the spiritual path, yes, is bliss. But bliss is the result of freedom. And what we're really looking for in our lives at all times is freedom. Not freedom to do whatever the ego wants to do. That was my generation's myth. Oh, look, we're just going to throw away all traditional morality, everything like that, and that's going to make us so happy. And it didn't, because we were still profoundly compelled by the body and the ego. But true freedom is to transcend body, ego, everything. That's the state of a true master, is complete freedom. And freedom comes from expanding awareness. And the more aware we are, the more capable we are of objectively understanding where we are, where we're coming from, where we're going. Now, I completely forgot how that related to the topic. But I will remember. Just give me a minute here. So I was saying, freedom, expanded awareness. No, dear, it was a straight line, and now I've lost it. I was talking about fear, and then, the purpose of life. Oh, that's what it was. I remember now. Because we ask God's guidance for things about which he has no opinion. That was where I was. Okay. So we think that it matters enormously whether I marry this person, for example, which seems like a fairly major decision, whether I have children, whether I live in this city, whether I have this job, whether I do this kind of work, anything like that. But from the divine perspective, and you have to add into this reincarnation or nothing makes any sense, so I'm just going to assume it. If you wish to dispute it, we can dispute it tomorrow, but right now I'm just going to assume it, okay? A longer span in which the same essential individuality evolves through many different bodies. That individuality is called the jiva. I don't like to use a lot of Sanskrit words, but there's no word in English. We tend to call it the soul, but that's a little confusing. The word is jiva. That's your individual infinite self. The infinite self that's you as an individual, the jiva that's you. From the divine point of view, from the big picture, we enter a body, we leave it, we enter a body, we leave it, we enter a body, we leave it, life and death I'm talking about. I'm not talking about possession or anything like that, right? That exists too, but that's not what I'm talking about. You're born in a baby body, you live in that one the whole time, and then at some point you shed it. At an old age or a young age, it goes away. Okay, but you're born with a certain consciousness, and hopefully over the course of a lifetime you expand that consciousness, you expand your awareness, and you die with a more expanded consciousness. We learn something, in other words. Some people don't, but let's say that everyone who's come to this place does learn something. And when you die, nothing goes with you. Not your gender, not your relations, not your possessions. And I, you know, jokingly, when you go into heaven, people don't say, oh, wow, look, there's that man who made all that money on the stock market, you know, and, oh, they had that beautiful house by the lake, you know. Nobody thinks like that. It's just you're a vibration at that point. You're a vibration of consciousness, and you vibrate at whatever level of consciousness you are. And that's all about the chakras and all kinds of fascinating things that go with that. But that's all you ever are. That's all you ever are right now. Right now, you, I, all of us, we are vibrating at a certain level of consciousness, which is the sum total of everything we've done up until this point brings to a perfect focus. That was Swami Kriyananda walking in that door. He vibrated at a vibration of consciousness I had never seen before, but I remembered it. I remembered it, and as soon as I saw it, I thought, that's it. That's where I'm trying to go. I had just never seen it anywhere around me. But from past incarnations, I remembered that it was there. And I knew philosophically that it was possible from reading these books. But that's all you ever have, is your vibration of consciousness. So all that ever matters in our lives, from the point of view of, let's call her Divine Mother, from our Divine Mother, just like a human mother raising a child is not real concerned if that child is not always pleased with what the mother does. I knew one poor mother who could, quote, couldn't stand to hear her children cry, and mamma mia, did she ruin those children. You know? Because sometimes it really just, like, doesn't really matter to you if your child is upset. My sisters raised a son, and he was very strong-willed, and she was very strong-willed. And when he was about 4 or 5, we were all visiting together, and he was trying to wheedle his way out of some very specific rule that she'd laid down. And she looked at him, and she said, "When I speak to you like this, have I ever changed my mind?" You know? And he had to sort of think, and he said, "No." Well, she said, "It's not going to happen now." You know, it's just like sometimes you just have to put it down. And then she said to him, "You have two choices. We can walk out of this house together, and when you go home, you can do anything you want, or I will carry you out, and when we go home, I'm going to lock you in your room. Which one would you like?" No, he thinks about it for a moment, and then they walk out together. But it's like, at that point, you realize that this is the right thing. And she was very fair, and it was a very appropriate response. You know, it's the right thing. It doesn't make any difference what he wanted. He was born in previous lifetimes, many previous lifetimes. I know he was a lawyer in New York City, probably, so he's a real argumentative child. But, you know, so he always had an angle on it. But it didn't matter, you know. Sometimes his angle didn't make any difference. Well, this is how we are in our lives. We think we know what's right, don't we? We think we know. And if you actually ask yourself, what makes me so sure? Well, I've read novels and seen movies, and, you know, I've given a lot of classes on relationships, and I'm, you know, I'm just amazed. I mean, almost all people's information about romantic relationships comes from television, music, celebrity magazines nowadays, movies, and novels. And what do all those things have in common? They're fiction, 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 fiction. We don't live in extended families. We don't see multi-generations. We don't live in even in neighborhoods anymore. And then we just act as if this is the truth. Somebody actually described to me their ideal relationship, and they used a movie to illustrate it. That was, you know, real self-control on my part. Because you don't want to just say, oh, my God, woman, are you out of your mind? You know, I had to say something that was more supportive. So I tried to, but it was, that was a tough moment. But so we think, we mistake pleasure for happiness. We don't understand that happiness is freedom. Because happiness is the freedom to be able to do what's right on a consistent basis, right meaning that which will bring me the greatest happiness. Not only this minute, but the next minute and the minute after, that will set in motion those vibrations which will bring me to the state of consciousness that I really want to have. And we think that pleasure is the same as that. But the mother knows when it looks at the child that what might be pleasurable for you now will be hell to pay when you're 30. And so I'm going to teach it to you now that you're 4. Because you'll learn it when you're 4, and it's not going to be pleasurable, but it's going to give you the freedom to do what you really need to do for where you're really going, because you're not always going to be my little baby in the house. A friend of mine trying to potty train her little boy, and he was not interested. She, of course, gave up finally, because even though he was a little old, he just wasn't interested. We said to each other, he will learn. We know that he will learn, so we don't have to worry. But she said, don't you want to be a big boy? He said, no. I like being a baby. And she just said, this is not the moment. Let's just let this pass. And we sort of have that with Divine Mother. Don't you want to learn? And oftentimes we say, no, I like being a baby. But we can only be a baby so long. And so oftentimes we demand of Divine Mother, and this is the second reason why it's hard to hear, is we're asking a question and we want a divine confirmation for something that doesn't make any difference. Should I live here? Should I live there? Should I do this? Should I do that? Should I go to this place? Should I go to that place? The question is, how can I expand my consciousness? How can I learn to love more purely? How can I serve? You know, how can I be an instrument of divine consciousness in this world? Ah, now we're getting somewhere. And very often, we realize, and God makes it clear to us, choose any of those options. Swami Kriyananda once said, and this unfortunately is probably pretty true for us, this woman came, it's all so many things are about the heartbreak of relationships, and I'm not being cynical, it's just a fact. This woman comes in and she was involved with a really horrible man, and they brought the worst out of each other. He wasn't a really uplifted character, and he got worse when he was with her. It was just not a good scene. Any common sense would tell you it was not a good scene. But she had this superstitious belief that there was some destined somebody, and she was afraid that this man might be that destined somebody. So she came to Swami Kriyananda and asked him the question, you know, essentially, is he the one? Mm-hmm. And Swami, who's not at all romantic about these things, you know, he sort of guided her in a very appropriate way. He often would have me in the room when he would talk to people. I listened to him, and he guided her very appropriately and, you know, encouraged her to use her common sense. Well, you fight all the time. You don't share core values. You know, a few things like that that you might think are clues that maybe you don't belong together. And then she left. And then he turned to me, and he said, you know, she has so many karmic lessons to learn. She could learn them with any number of people. He said, you have to be very highly advanced before your karmic choices have narrowed so much. You know, if this is a growing situation for you, the question is, how can I grow? The question is, am I using this situation to the best advantage for myself spiritually? The question is, Divine Mother, how can I learn more? How can I find a place where I can, you know, be on the edge of what I need to know? And if I'm not finding it here, give me creative ideas about how I can find it. And those are questions that have real answers, you see, because now you're asking God to help you move in the direction that God cares about. If we just are going in circles and just changing our dresses every day, it's just not really going to make any difference, because in the end, our vibration will be just the same. So we have difficulty understanding because We're afraid to know. We have difficulty understanding because it's not a divine question. And we have to ask a divine question. We have to ask a question that is of concern to our own higher consciousness. And those are two of, you know, a great many things that will really begin to help. I'm putting them in the negative, but what the overall point here is a very simple one, which is, it's not hard to know. I'm going to just, and I don't have time to go into this in tremendous length. I can send you to that website and you'll find other talks. There's one more point that I'll say, and then I'll take a few questions. We also have to understand that whereas we tend to think of ourselves as a singularity in our inner consciousness, as if we were athletes, we would think of ourselves as long-distance runners, right? In fact, our inner consciousness is more like an entire sports team, like a football team or some, you know, some group that has a lot of players. And all of them are us. We have a whole crowd of mental citizens, so to speak. And as is true of any team, people have different, they have different functions, and some of them are more superstars than others. So the first thing about us is that we have many inner voices, just inner voices in terms of all the different aspects of ourselves that are vying for attention and need to be developed. We also have many inner voices in that there are, and this I'll say it just very simply, there's essentially up to two fundamental states of consciousness that we have. One is what is commonly called the subconscious, but I don't mean that the way Jung meant it or that it's meant in psychology. But the subconscious is the accumulated everything that we've done up until this point, including all our previous lives. It's the pattern that presently exists in the chakras of all the energy that we have, all the decisions, everything we've ever done, all the experiences that are registered as vibrations within us, where we've been. On this side, we have the superconscious, which is where the jiva connects to the infinite, and it's the doorway to freedom, and it's where the divine comes in and speaks to us. So on one side, we're always being called. Someone wrote me a letter and asked me once, at what point does the soul begin to seek God? I said, at what point does the river begin to flow to the sea? If there's a river, it's flowing to the sea. As soon as we are conscious of individuality, we are also trying to merge back into the infinite. It's always there. Whether we're aware of it or not, it's always pulling us. That's the desire for bliss that makes us discontent without it. That's our souls flowing to the infinite sea. It's always there pulling us. Simultaneously, we're being pulled by habit, by comfort, by familiarity, by security, by complexes, by everything that we've been up until now. And that this is the subconscious, this is the superconscious, and the conscious mind where we live is the battleground between the two. And that's where we live all the time, is in this battleground. Isn't that so? Mm-hmm. I mean, how many of you already 100 times today have thought, maybe I'll have that piece of chocolate. No, I think I won't. But then maybe I will, and then I could, and then maybe I will, you know? Or here I am, you know, it's 5:30. If I get up now, I can do a whole set of yoga postures, and then I can have a long meditation. Or else I could just go back to sleep, right? Or before I do those yoga postures, maybe I'll just check my emails. And now that I've done my emails, maybe I'll have a cup of coffee, and then maybe I'll call someone on the East Coast, and then it's 7, and you know, just like there, always, the battleground. It's the battle in the Gita. It's the battle of Kurukshetra. It's the field of battle in which the Bhagavad Gita takes place, the field of consciousness. But all of it is inside of us, and it's not always obvious who's talking. So we can have very strong inner feelings, and they really are inner voices. But who's talking? Lineage matters. The difference between being guided superconsciously and merely responding to a strong existing energy, it's not necessarily that this is wrong, but just because we feel it strongly inside, we have to also compare it to where we're trying to go. And I'll give you the last best help in understanding inner guidance. Realize that if you can receive inner guidance, so can the people around you. And oftentimes, they're looking at you, and they can understand you better than you can understand yourself. So it's not like you go around to everybody and say, what do you think, what do you think, what do you think, what do you think? But it's helpful to say, And above all, it's very helpful to cultivate in your life at least a few people who you know have objective wisdom and have an impartial interest in your welfare. Because, I mean, I realized the reason that I shied away from this subject for so long is because I have to be fair to myself. I have a lot of intuition. But one of the ways I've cultivated that is that I've also had people in my life to whom I could bring it and say, what does this look like to you? And I've had my good friends lots of times say, that is about the stupidest idea I've ever heard, you know, or you've got to be kidding. But I feel it so strongly. Well, that doesn't mean anything, you know, just who will really reflect back to me honestly and then work with me. So I think it's very, very difficult by yourself to really have certainty. And you have to work. It's part of building community, is to develop impartial friends in your life who can help you, so that then they help you sort through your fears, they help you understand what level it's coming from, they help you understand what the real question is. Because you can be often even very intuitive about other people and completely bewildered about yourself, because we're on the inside of it and we don't even know. You know, I was 50 years old before I realized an absolutely fundamental aspect of my character that had been inculcated into me by my family. And it had caused me no end of trouble in my life, but it had never occurred to me that it was an imitative behavior on my part. I was 50, and I'd been on the spiritual path since I was 18 years old. So don't ever underestimate the power of being inside of it. You don't have to be paranoid. Just be extremely respectful of it, okay? So I'm going to take a couple of questions, if you have any. And does anyone have anything they'd like to ask? Comment? Protest? Yes?
You told us about building a community of impartial, objective, loving people.
Right.
And being aware of the battleground we're living on and the influences that may be influencing
right.
voices we hear. What role does daily spiritual practice play in sorting out the voices?
The right kind of meditation withdraws you from the external world, which is to say silent meditation. It draws you into the center of your being. I mean, and many people teach these practices. You know, breath meditation, breath is the center of your being. Breath is the link between, you know, breath is an interesting reality because you have a certain amount of conscious control over it, and a certain amount of it is unconscious. You can't kill yourself by holding your breath. If you hold your breath, you will pass out and then you will breathe. But you can also influence your breath, and your breath is strongly influenced by consciousness. In other words, your breath reflects your consciousness. If you're so excited and you're talking like this, you know, that's your breath is right there. And if you're being very concentrated, often you don't even breathe at all. You just pause. I mean, you can see just in that tiny demonstration how much breath relates. Actors know that. So any meditation that draws you into the center, that disconnects you from all of your external distractions, and then that takes the energy and raises it up to the chakras, preferably to the spiritual eye. Because what that's doing is that's raising you out of the subconscious into the superconscious. And when we're in the superconscious is when true inspiration and understanding comes. Because what we're looking for is true intuition is superconscious intuition. And, you know, the second half of this is how do you trust it? Well, you trust it because you learn. You trust it because you make really terrible mistakes. And from those mistakes, you learn. And then you gradually begin to tell the difference. Is that enough of an answer? Meditation is critical. It's one of the most critically helpful things, whether you practice it formally or informally. It's interiorizing, and then you intensify, interiorize, and elevate with your energy, and then everything is much clearer. Okay, Paula?
Yes, Asha, you said that you had that sort of profound discovery at 50.
Yeah.
And not to ask what it was personally.
Oh, I don't mind. I have no secrets. Okay. Yeah, the entire planet knows, but go ahead.
Was it maybe a core issue that you didn't realize it really? So if you could.
Well, what it was my I'm the middle child of three. My brother, I actually was born in El Paso, Texas, and my brother was twice state debate champion of Texas in the 60s, and I was into debate for a little while. I thought that debate and conversation were the same thing, and I didn't know. at our dinner table, and we were all, I'm from a Jewish background, and I can speak of Jewish stereotypes because I am one. It's okay. So we have that energy. And so conversation to me is you get your 2 minutes, you muster all your best arguments, and you present them as fast as you can with all the force you can. My husband says to me, that is not a conversation opener, that's a conversation stopper. That's what he says. He said this to me for about 15 years. I never heard it. I never understood. I just thought then you take your turn and you present your best arguments and then I'll counter them. And I was always surprised that people didn't engage. Mm-hmm. But it was like, everybody around me, they all just said, uh-huh. But I had no idea. I had no idea. Isn't it amazing? I just had no idea. That's how I thought people talked to each other. Why did I not notice? But I didn't. Okay? That's the kind of core issue I meant. And it was just because it was so visceral with me. And I mean, I'm not even close to my family. I mean, my parents are gone, and my sister and I see each other often, and I'm in touch with my brother. But it's not like I even live with them. I left home at 18. But it was so in me that there it was. Yes, Mark?
Going back to the story about the woman who was afraid that the man she was with was going to be the one, and if she left him, right, she was not the one. And you said something there that I'd like for you to go into a little bit deeper because I'm not sure I got it.
Okay.
The thing about it, you have to be more advanced. Well, the karmic choices
are so narrowed. It's a very key question because the question just because this is getting guidance for something that matters to God. See, we think what matters is who I live with, who's my spouse, whether we have children, who the children are, where we live, what I do. What matters to God is, are you loving? Are you serving? Are you expanding your consciousness? Are you opening your heart? Now, we also have affinities, karmic affinities, for certain ways of being, for certain places, for certain work. That's the part that's the subconscious part that's moving us. It's, I said, it's not all bad. It's also pushing us in a certain direction. So, when I first saw David, whom I've been married to now for almost 30 years, I just liked him. I didn't have any sense that we would be married. It wasn't like I had that kind of flesh. But the moment I saw him, I really liked him. And oddly enough, when he called my parents' house, my father liked his voice on the phone. Mm-hmm. It's just like there's an affinity there. He didn't think much of me. I always give him the chance to tell the story over again, and it never comes out any different than, But anyway, so it's not as if you can randomly just sort of match up any two people anywhere and they'll be fine. That's naive, because we aren't that free. If we were totally free, we could do that, but we're not that free. But at the same time, to think that every little step I take is just so cosmically determined, and that if I do this, that'll be right, and if I do this, that'll be wrong, and because it can freeze us up. And it's not so. If we enter into it with an open-minded willingness to learn from it, then we can learn in many different situations. But then sometimes the situation dies. I was married before I was married to David. I was married when I was young. I married at 19, and I divorced at 24 after I came to Ananda. And very good man. We had a lot of affinity for each other. But I just reached the point where it wasn't a positive thing anymore. And I said to Swami Kriyananda at that, I said, my concern was this. I said, I loved him so much, and now I just would really like to be somewhere else. I said, how can I ever trust myself again? And he played a game with me, Swamiji said. He said, well, maybe the karma is between you is over. And he let me sort of go like that, you know. But then he added, but I don't think so. But he said, I think you've taken it as far as you can in this lifetime. He said, it just needs to go on the shelf now, and you need to go do something else. And, you know, it'll, he said, you know, basically, don't worry. He didn't necessarily mean, you don't necessarily, and this is, we can talk about this more tomorrow, didn't necessarily mean I'd have to work it out with him. But whatever it is that was still, you know, unresolved, as a vibration, I would get a chance to resolve it. And maybe it would come back in that specific form, you know, with that individual, or maybe I would just learn it somewhere else. But a finish now. He said, you just need to go work over here now. And so that's why sometimes, you know, you say, how can I serve? And then it may be I'm just dead in the water over here. I've run out of creative ideas. I've run out of energy. I've run out of steam. I've run out of affection. I've run out of whatever. I just need to put that aside and go over here now and then work on this one. And then you do. You find your spot and, you know, it, you just know you're in the flow. It's working. It might be hard. It might be easy. But you know where you're supposed to be. And sometimes you're just finished and you have to be creative somewhere else. Does that answer it better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Sometimes you get to learn from being fulfilled, and sometimes you get to learn from being frustrated. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a kind of, fulfillment is better. Who had a hand back here? Yes.
What is your definition of serving?
Mashed potatoes and gravy.
That's not a bad start. Helping others to move in directions that are ultimately helpful to them, you know? And you can do that by making beautiful paintings. You can do that by serving mashed potatoes and gravy, seriously. But what you're doing something that is uplifting consciousness. And that doesn't have to be big and grand. I mean, most of us are just, you know, our lives are, you know, after history is over, we're just going to be washed off the page. It, you know, very few of us are going to make any impact at all on the big society, but will make a huge impact on our own consciousness. And so, you know, if you're a mother raising kids, you just do it with the spirit where you're really moving them forward. If you're a secretary in an office, you just try to be the little bubble of light for what other people need. If you're a bank teller, you try to relate to the people you're relating to. If you're a hermit, you try to send emanations of peace out to the world. But you're, in some way, you're not just taking for yourself, you're also giving back. You know, the work that I do, which is this, I just say to people, you know, Swami Kriyananda gave me so much that if I never stopped talking until my last breath, I would not begin to repay what's been given to me. And that's how I feel. I just feel like I've been given this and I just have to keep giving it back. And that's my service. You know, it takes other forms too, but that's my main thought. That's what I do in life. Fair? Yeah. Okay. Okay, why don't we just have a little bit of music and then we'll call it a night. How does that work for you all? Okay.